Hello, Blogging Heads Nation, and Happy New Year. To start off 2009, we've got what should be a really fascinating and warning profound and quite serious discussion this morning. As many of you know, I'm Heather Hurlburt, the Executive Director of the National Security Network in Washington, D.C., and I'm talking today with Professor Andrew Bacevich from Boston University, also with a distinguished career in the Army behind him, and the author of a new book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. What we thought we'd do this morning is let Professor Bacevich tell us a little bit about the book and then have the fun of applying his critique of American national security policy to a couple of items that are in the news this week. So with that, Andy, I'll turn it over to you and let you tell everybody what the critique is.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me do this interview with you. I think, in essence, the core message of the book is that the crisis confronting the United States today, and I would emphasize the book came out about a month before the economic collapse became apparent, that the crisis confronting the United States today really is a domestic crisis more than a foreign policy crisis, or to put it another way, the solution to our problems, if there is a solution, is to be found at home, not to be found abroad. And to really cut to the chase, the problem is that for too long we have refused to live within our means, and that it's really become time for us to clean up our act. Beyond that, the book argues that our political system not only has demonstrated an inability to help us live within our means, but in many respects acts as an enabler, trying to postpone a day of reckoning. And finally, the book argues that our foreign policy, very broadly speaking, amounts to an effort to try to manage this domestic dysfunction. The effort being based on an assumption of American military supremacy and a kind of an infinite American military capability, which events in the last 7 years have shown to be an illusion. So the book breaks down, tries to describe three different crises: the crisis of profligacy, the political crisis, which has to do with the dysfunction of our political system, and then the military crisis, which has to do with the overemphasis placed on military power as an antidote to our problems.
Many commentators have made some version of the argument you make about Americans failing to live within our means. Very few have made it from the spiritual angle that you take, and even fewer who advocate a smaller U.S. presence in the world have made it from an explicitly Christian and theological perspective. It's not every day you pick up a book about international relations and find yourself confronted with Reinhold Niebuhr on almost every page. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, and also, as I say, because it is so unusual to find somebody who is a leading West Point strategist relying quite so heavily on a Catholic theologian's view of the world. So maybe talk a little bit about how you see the two spheres intersecting.
Well, I probably wouldn't use the word spiritual to describe my critique. And when I say that, I don't mean I'm trying to run away either from the emphasis I place on Reinhold Niebuhr, nor am I trying to run away from my own Catholic identity. But I think the word I would use in lieu of spiritual is cultural. I think that one of the reasons that we have gone down the mistaken path that we followed, leading us to this penchant for living beyond our means, is a great cultural crisis. And the essence of that cultural crisis lies in our collective embrace of a very false notion of freedom, in which freedom really has come to be to many, many Americans, and I don't mean to say all. Freedom really has come to be identified with conspicuous consumption and self-indulgence. Or to put it another way, freedom is not tethered to any conception of truth or of permanent values. I know that we live in a pluralistic society, and it would be not only misguided but wrong for any one person to insist that there is one truth or one set of truths that should inform the meaning of freedom. But even in a pluralistic society, I think, where I think there are many truths which compete with one another, I think what we need to do is to recognize that the concept of freedom untethered from truth really becomes exceedingly shallow, and I think at odds with the notion of living a humane or a complete sort of existence. So I suppose that's kind of a very pretentious way of saying that the penchant we have for consumption, for shop till you drop, for the acquisition of material goods in some endless supply, really lies at the very heart, I think, of the challenges that the country faces. But again, I'd probably want to use the word cultural rather than spiritual. Niebuhr is very much an important figure in the book. Many people will recall that Niebuhr was one of the great public intellectuals of the 30s and 40s and 50s, even into the 1960s. By training, by calling, he was a Protestant theologian. And I became drawn to Niebuhr when I became an academic back in the 1990s, and drawn to him in particular because of my perplexity at the direction that U.S. foreign policy was taking in the wake of the Cold War. And he became one of the figures who was most important to me in helping me rethink the internal dynamics of U.S. foreign policy. In other words, help me rethink what is it that makes us do what we do as a country with respect to the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's a shame in a way. It's interesting that Niebuhr's not more widely read today, and I'd like to see you start a Niebuhr revival, because he does mount a very trenchant criticism of U.S. foreign policy, but also domestic policy as it emerges in response to the Cold War in the 50s. I guess what struck me, being a sort of classic observant liberal Christian myself, was that I was with you all the way on this argument until we got to the sort of point you make about the turning point on all of this having been Elvis the Pill and Woodstock. And I guess I really found myself muttering and shaking my head at the book at that point and wanting to make a smart-ass comment about, no, just the 60s were the moment where the rest of us got in on the materialist culture that white men had been promoting for quite some time before that. So I wanted, I think this is the moment where the sort of classic liberal-conservative divide does emerge over whether one sees the 60s as a watershed for all that is now wrong with America. And I wanted to push you on that a little bit, because I think I would even agree with many of the places where you say we have a cultural crisis over materialism, over our untethering from values that are more important than, as we were saying before we got on the call, the size of your house and so on and so forth. But I think that there was a problematic deadness in the culture before the 1960s.
I suspect that we don't disagree as much as, well, maybe we do, but I'm guessing we don't disagree as much as that comment suggests. What I was trying to say about the 1960s was this. I tried to, I'm very much coming at it from a conservative's perspective. I should say parenthetically, Bush, Cheney, people like that have nothing to do with conservatism, principled conservatism. But coming at the 60s from the position of what I hope is a principled conservative, I tried to acknowledge and indeed pay tribute to the fact that the 1960s was the period of time, and we're using that term very loosely, I know, but the 1960s was that period of time in which emphatically the access to freedom, or the period of time when people who had not been allowed access to freedom finally gained that access. They weren't given it. They had to seize it, to work for it. Most prominently African Americans, but not just African Americans. Certainly women and Hispanics and the disabled and gays, for all those groups, the 1960s is the period of time when they are cut in to the American way of life. And in that regard, enormous injustices are at least partly corrected. I also try to be very clear in the book that the credit for all of that belongs to people on the left, that people on the right never cared in any significant way about freedom for African Americans or equality for women or the concerns of the disabled or right on down the pike. So I'm not trying to be simply a crabby old right-winger who is blaming all of the country's problems on what happened during that particular decade. I'm trying to say that some profoundly important and indeed very good things happened during that decade. At the same time, I do believe, and maybe this is where I am a crappy right-winger, that the emphasis on freedom assumed a cast which basically said, you define it your way and I'll define it my way. You do what you want and I'll do what I want. And although, on the one hand, that's an extraordinarily exciting proposition, on the other hand, most of us, I think, don't really have the capacity to come to a viable definition of what freedom means unless we have some kind of fixed reference points which possess some authority. Now, whether those fixed reference points are traditional religion or traditional cultural norms or whatever, I don't know. But it seems to me that one of the consequences of this enormous emphasis on freedom in the 1960s was that freedom became, in a sense, a do-it-your-own proposition. Now, one could say, I think, that there are some people for whom that kind of autonomy really is liberating and creates opportunities for exploration, invention, which can be tremendously fulfilling. On the other hand, for the great majority of people, I think it leaves them adrift. And in many respects, I think that when you look at the pathologies which afflict American society today, whether we're talking about the plight of young African American males or the number of children who are growing up in absent the sort of parenting we would hope that all children would have, I think those pathologies in many respects cannot be blamed on, but also cannot be disconnected from the erosion of authority, or the way that reference points lost their significance after the 1960s. I don't know if that made any sense, but that would be my rather long-winded response.
No, I mean, I thought you were very carefully and eloquently putting a sort of classic conservative argument, and so I think that is the nub of where we would disagree. And what's interesting to me, because it relates back to something else that you comment on in the book, is that it reflects a classic conservative distrust of the great majority of peoples. Mm-hmm. Inability to make the right decisions for themselves without what you've delicately called guideposts, and others would put mm-hmm. in a blunter way. And I, mm-hmm. I have, I guess, one sort of larger moral.
Just to interrupt for a second. I mean, you used the word distrust, and I find myself, you know, bridling a little bit at that because I don't think of it as distrust, and yet I have to concede that there. You got a heck of a lot of it right. I don't know if it's distrust, but it's a sense that the vast majority of us, me included, emphatically me included, do need these guideposts or reference points in order to help us sort of navigate our way through human existence.
Right.
So, but I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all, because what I think the core difference between us right there is that we both agree that people need guideposts, which makes me a kind of old-fashioned liberal in many respects, but that I'm of the view that on net, more of us are more better off in a world where we have to find our own guideposts in a confusing multiplicity, even if that means difficulty along the way, and that in general we have one set of difficulties even as we've shucked off another set. And so, you know, I think of, for example, the statistic you so delicately alluded to of children growing up in one-parent households, which I would agree with you is not optimal, but massive amounts of spousal abuse are also not optimal. An expectation that one partner is a chattel in a relationship is also not optimal and is deforming to both the intellect and the moral sense of both partners. So, you know, the social changes that the 60s unleashed, it seems to me, did swap one set of problems for another set, or to be more accurate, introduced a new set without entirely making the old set go away. And it seems to me that it's a little bit dependent on one's sort of core outlook on the world, which set is more problematic, and I certainly know that's where you and I have a core difference. But I want to pull this back to foreign policy a little bit, because you comment very scathingly in the book in your discussion of what's wrong with the political class in America, which of course I belong to, and in some sense you do as well. But that one of the things that's wrong with Washington in general and with the legislative branch in particular is its contempt for the American people. But the interesting thing is that it's the view that sort of Washington has of Americans on national security, which is they don't know the issues, they don't know what they want, they need somebody else to tell them, and we just need to figure out what's best and do it, in many ways grows out of the kind of conservative view of what the mind of the masses is good for that you've just enunciated a very mild version of. And I mean, one of the things I was struck by in reading your book is that, in fact, the public wanted to be asked to do more after 9/11, for example.
Right.
And you're very scathing on how few Americans chose to join the military, but rates of volunteerism went way up, actually. Interest in world affairs went way up, and so people were actually looking for a whole range of ways to get involved and stress a feeling of renewed commitment to community. I think people also.
How long did that last?
The volunteerism, I don't know how long that lasted. The news, I do know it lasted about a year. And here is, I think,
it was a passing phenomenon.
But this is where I think it's a little more complicated than just saying the people this, the people that. The public wanted to know more about the rest of the world, and initially the media responded and gave them more about the rest of the world, but what they got was just stories about the U.S. military in the rest of the world.
Fair enough.
There actually wasn't a net increase in coverage of what are those people doing out there? There was a net increase in coverage of our brave American soldiers, which, of course, you would expect when the country is in a war and then in another war. But so, in fact, the public didn't get what it was looking for, and then it went back to Britney Spears or whatever it was doing before. You know, similarly, I think the volunteerism, there were, as you note in the book, and here again, you and I completely agree, there was very little reinforcement from our government of the idea that there should be any kind of selfless or community or broader than the individual response to what happened on 9/11. And so where I think people had basically good instincts, they were not encouraged. And so many of the dynamics that you sort of posit as being, well, the American people are this and the American people are that, I actually think some of that should be a broader indictment of our political and media classes for actually not sort of for going back time and time again to cheap, easy consumerist solutions rather than encouraging.
I don't think I disagree with you at all. I mean, let me put it another way. I agree emphatically that in the immediate wake of 9/11, not only was there a tremendous surge of interest in world affairs. Anybody who teaches in a college or university would agree with that. But there was a sense on the part of the country that was palpable of wanting to contribute, of wanting to be part of what the nation's response to this awful event was going to be. And President Bush rather explicitly decided to nip that inclination in the bud. And then the famous remark that he made at O'Hare Airport about, you know, live life the way we want it to be lived and go to Disney World. And I do believe that, not immediately, not overnight, but over the period of the next year or so, the great majority of the people decided, well, we'll just do as the president has instructed us, and we will go back to doing what we were doing before, and let's go to the mall.
Yeah.
So I emphatically think that the president, from my point of view, made a great error in saying what he said. I also think that it was done with malice aforethought, that the administration, in calculating how best to go, how to maximize its freedom of action in conducting the global war on terror, decided that marginalizing the people would be a good thing to do.
By making
the people spectators, that the core of decision makers at the center would be able to fight the war the way they wanted to fight it. And they already, I think, were beginning to, rather quickly, began to develop the notion that the war was going to be one that was going to include very radical notions like the embrace of preventive war and going after Saddam Hussein. So having an engaged, a critically engaged electorate would not have been particularly useful. And so they fixed that problem by telling the American people to go shopping.
It is a particularly dismaying feature of public opinion research on national security that the public is incredibly invested in believing that their leaders, whoever they are telling them the truth and doing the right thing. That where on domestic policy issues you've got much more kind of inherent willingness to be critical, but on national security there's this incredible just commitment to believe that whoever it is in charge is telling us the truth, which leads me to the critique you make of our military establishment in particular. And I have to say, as a good liberal, one of the things I was really hoping for from the Bush administration was strong civilian appointees who would be able to reestablish civilian control of the military, and in some ways that had slipped, and especially under the Clinton administration, where you had the set of challenges and missteps that we had. And instead, as you note in the book, you know, the great irony is that to some extent the reverse happened, and we're even farther from that than we were. Mm-hmm. But then you turn around and are quite harsh on the uniformed military leadership as well. And I wonder if you'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Well, I'm harsh on the military leadership at the very highest levels. And what I mean here is that at that four-star echelon of the officer corps, there are a handful of officers in a handful of jobs where the responsibilities inherent in the office really straddle the boundary between strategy and politics, or between war and diplomacy. Over the past 7-8 years, we've had, I believe it's three, chairs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Myers, Pace, and now Admiral Mullins. They would fit into that category. The so-called regional combatant commanders, particularly the commander of Central Command, falls in that category. Tommy Franks, followed by, I'm forgetting his name now, John Abizade, and now Petraeus. And the successive commanders in Baghdad, Ricardo Sanchez, George Casey, Petraeus, Ordierno, that group of people, that's the people I'm talking about. They are not simply military advisors or military commanders. They are people whose, whatever the job description may be, their job really involves trying to connect war with politics in useful ways or effective ways. And I think by and large, that group of people has done at best a mediocre job since the global war on terror began. And even as we pay tribute to the efforts of the soldiers who most directly bear the burden of waging the global war on terror, whether in Iraq or in Afghanistan or wherever, I think it's also necessary for us to insist upon high standards of accountability with regard to the performance of military leaders at that very high level.
What would
their,
that look
their
like?
Job is a tremendously tough one because the business they're in is a tough one, but they haven't done a good job.
If you're looking at it from the perspective of imposing outside accountability, I'm thinking particularly of the kind of congressional oversight you could hypothetically imagine, but that we haven't had for a long time. What would,
big
what
point,
would real accountability
point.
For the uniformed leadership look like?
Well, let's take the example of the first three commanders in Baghdad. That would be Franks and Sanchez and then Casey. Franks failed to plan properly for the occupation of the country. And that failure created the conditions out of which the insurgency came into existence. A failure of planning and execution that has cost the country dearly. We're still not out of there, and we won't be out of there for years to come. Well, he should not, upon retirement, have been awarded the Medal of Freedom. He was followed by Sanchez. Sanchez inherited a bad condition and made it worse. Sanchez did not understand the military problem that he faced, and the means he employed to try to deal with the insurgency actually exacerbated the level of violence. When he left command after a year, Donald Rumsfeld wanted to promote him from a three-star general to a four-star general and appoint him in command of Southern Command. Now, there was a significant amount of response both in Congress and in the media that suggested that Sanchez had screwed up and didn't deserve to be promoted, and ultimately he was not. That was being held accountable. Sanchez was followed by George Casey, a four-star general. And Casey, I think, also fundamentally misunderstood the problem. And I'm sure he's a good guy. I'm sure he tried hard. I'm sure he did the best he could, but over the course of his, I think it was roughly a year and a half in command, again, the level of violence simply got worse. When he was removed from command by President Bush, he was made Chief of Staff of the United States Army. In effect, he was promoted. He should not have been. He should have been told that he had failed in his mission and that therefore, he should be retired. Doesn't mean we take him out in the alley and shoot him, but we don't promote people. We don't advance people who fail to fulfill their responsibilities. And that's what happened in the case of George Casey.
There's been a lot of back and forth discussion about General Petraeus's future political ambitions and efforts among some conservatives, but also among some progressives, to claim him and his ideas as their own. And you know, on the one hand, I see that as kind of an interesting civilian level of attention to military strategy. On the other hand, an unwelcome level of politicization that ultimately perhaps hurts everyone more than it helps them. And I wonder your views on that.
I'm with you 100%. I mean, I personally found most objectionable General Wesley Clark's bid for the presidency and General Clark's involvement in Democratic Party politics in the wake of his departure from active duty. It seems to me that it is both in the best interests of the country and also emphatically in the best interest of the officer corps for retired generals to stay out of politics. Yes, they are citizens. Yes, they absolutely have the same rights to speak out or to participate in politics that any other citizen has. But it seems to me that if one is really concerned about the best interests of the country and about the best interests of the officer corps, those are rights that very senior officers should choose not to exercise. So I have no idea what General Petraeus's ambitions are for the rest of his life, but I myself would very much hope that he would not choose to enter into politics once he leaves the military.
Yeah, I would draw the line, I guess, in a somewhat different place. And in the interest of honesty, I'll say that one of the things I do at work in my day job is actually work with retired flag officers, but also lower-level officers who want to participate in the national security process either in a nonpartisan way as issue advocates. We worked a lot with folks who'd been involved in Guantanamo and wanted to go out and talk to civilians about their experiences and what they thought was wrong, but also with people who are more interested in being involved in partisan politics. And I think, I mean, I'm tempted to ask you sort of your views on General Eisenhower, but I also think where I draw the line is that people need to be very careful to stay out of partisan politics while they're on active duty. And after retirement, I think we've created a real problem in that the disproportionate amount or the disproportionate extent to which so many institutions of government and public life are disrespected today, yet the military remains highly respected. It's almost an impossible burden to expect the representatives of the one institution that still commands so much respect in public life to stay out of the political arena. And I also think as we've created so many more tools and avenues for anybody to get involved in public life, the old idea of how the military stayed out of public life is challenged very hard. And I think we need to come to an understanding that rests in a slightly different place where, again, as I say, doing some things while you're on active duty are even more problematic, but doing other things once you're retired are perhaps less problematic.
Well, I mean, this is an argument you're winning. So, I mean, believe me.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about winning it I see your point.
I would simply note that. I would argue that. One of the reasons that the officer corps is respected is because it has been generally perceived to be above politics. Mm-hmm. That military officers, to include senior military officers, are seen to be people who put the interests of the country first. To the extent that very senior retired military officers, as soon as they take off their uniform, plunge into partisan politics, then it seems to me that that pattern of behavior over time is going to erode that perception that officers are people who put country first. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I am frankly appalled by the display that we get from both parties. Every time there's a presidential election now, of candidates competing to see who can line up the biggest group of former generals and admirals behind them. That candidates, in essence, are advertising themselves as the military's candidate. You know, vote for me because the military supports me. And I just am very uncomfortable with that. And I'm not going to tell you that I think somehow the Republic's in jeopardy as a consequence of this tendency, and it's a growing tendency, but I don't think it's good. And but having said that, I think that really it has become almost an irreversible aspect of our politics now. You know, in the old days, you know, people would try to figure out how many union leaders they could line up, or how many, I suppose, academics they could line up, or corporate heads. Now candidates want to go see how many admirals and generals they can line up behind them.
Well, as I say, I plead guilty to having done a small part to perpetuate this practice. And on the one hand, I would never want my side of the field to unilaterally disarm as long as the public has such a large respect for military leaders. But I would like to see some red lines. But I mean, you yourself came very close to endorsing Senator Obama. Some of your comments during the campaign could certainly be read that way. And I'm also sort of tempted to tweak you a little bit and ask you what the difference between General Eisenhower running for president and General Clark was, other than that Eisenhower won and Clark lost.
I'd say two things. First of all, although I am a retired military officer, first of all, I certainly was not a very senior officer. And secondly, you know, I don't advertise myself as Colonel retired. People quote me as Colonel retired, but I have tried in my own life to set aside that identity. And I am who I am. I'm a professor who teaches at Boston University, and I wish to have my views be evaluated based on that particular status. So point number one. Point number two on Eisenhower, who I admire significantly. I mean, he had his faults and made his mistakes, but was one of the most successful presidents of the past 60 years. I guess what I would say is that despite his success as president, in a way, it's Eisenhower's testimony in his famous farewell address, which stands as the most authoritative warning of the consequences of allowing. He didn't particularly talk about the officer corps, but in his discussion of the military-industrial complex, of allowing a militarized worldview or military considerations, he warned against the danger of allowing that to seep too deeply into our politics. I would guess that he would be as concerned as I am about this inclination that we've been talking about.
But I think exactly the conundrum that we've gotten ourselves into is that we're now at a point where the military-industrial complex is so deeply established that the only people who have credibility in complaining about it are people with military backgrounds. If you compare the relative interest in me, who runs a left-of-center think tank, saying something about the military-industrial complex, versus you, conservative historian, army veteran, saying something about it, it's much more impressive to everyone if you say it. And that's kind of the fundamental dynamic, at least on the Democratic side of the House,
right.
If you want to change anything about how the military works, the only way you can get enough credibility to do it is have military, what we call validators.
Yeah.
So there's a crazy way, I don't know, I certainly wish President-elect Obama Godspeed on this, but I don't know how you break that cycle without sort of getting into deeper dependence.
Yep.
And besides the fact that the military is just a reservoir of very talented people.
Right. Well, I mean,
we go looking for those folks because they're smart.
Right. I have a hard time refuting that. I mean, the problem of standing outside of the military profession and being able to be both a critic and to speak with authority is tough. In many respects, I think that, you were talking before about you were hoping that when the Republicans came back into power in 2001 that they would address the problems of civilian control that had cropped up during the Clinton era. I shared that hope, by the way. Of course, the irony is that I think in particular because of the performance of people like Donald Rumsfeld, that whole effort to restore civilian control had a profoundly mistaken effect. And Rumsfeld has, in many respects, served to discredit the notion that the Secretary of Defense should really be in charge, or the commander-in-chief for that matter. Although one could also say that Gates has done actually a pretty good job of repairing at least some of the damage that Rumsfeld did in that regard.
I was just going to ask you, so you're Secretary Gates. You know you have a limited tenure. You know, in a way, you're there to take the blame for some of what happens next. What are the things that Gates could do that would show a really profound commitment to addressing the problem?
Well, I'm pretty high on Gates. I'm dismayed by his sense that the solution to Afghanistan somehow lies in sending more U.S. troops there.
Yes, thank you for helping us segue into that point, which we promised our blogging headmasters to discuss.
But he's been very clear in saying that military power does not provide a solution to violent Islamic radicalism. He's been very clear in saying that after Iraq and Afghanistan, we ain't going to do this again. Meaning we're not going to be in the business of invading and occupying countries with the sense that we can fix them. I was reading this morning in the paper that he is not keen to have some big showdown with Russia. But actually is willing to interpret Russian behavior, not to endorse it, but to interpret Russian behavior in the context of the way we've treated the Russians over the past 20 years or so. So I do see him as a voice of reason and as someone who is helping us back away from the excessive militarization of U.S. policy that was so prominent in the first 4 or 5 years after 9/11. I think he's doing a real good job.
So on Afghanistan, because I think...
That's where he's not doing a good job.
Well, here's my view and question on Afghanistan, that what we really have is a complete lack of a long-term strategy and of a realistic, achievable goal for the U.S., the ongoing U.S. presence in the region. And so the first thing you need from a new administration, and this would be true whoever the administration was, is to set some goals and say we're not trying to turn Afghanistan into Switzerland. We understand that it isn't going to be a liberal democracy with women walking around in miniskirts. But our goals are, number one, to deny the possibility of the Taliban or somebody else coming back and taking over the entire state. Number two, to reduce dramatically the extent to which it can be used as a safe haven for terrorist planning.
Right.
And then number three, I think, and perhaps you and I would disagree, there's a moral obligation a sort of, this is my variant of the Pottery Barn, you broke it, you own it rule, that having gone in and removed a government that was god-awful in many respects, but that was providing a certain level of social peace, there's an obligation to at least set in place instruments by which the Afghans can, if they so choose, manage themselves in some kind of relatively peaceful and stable way. And my view is, and I have deliberately not mentioned the drug problem because I don't believe the solution to that is military, and that's one of the things we have to get our head around. Mm-hmm. But in order to do those three long-term things, there may be a short-term need to put in more troops, not because more troops are the solution, but because the administration allowed things to bump along so disastrously for a number of years. And so I'm of the view that it may not be the wrong thing to put in somewhat more troops in the short term, as long as you're clear about what you are and aren't doing there in the medium to long term.
What do you gain by putting these troops in for the short term?
Well, how are you going to remove, how are you going to push the Taliban back from the areas that they've retaken otherwise? How are you going to get the Afghan armed forces?
I think this goes to the point you made going into the Afghan discussion, and that is the absence of a strategy. My own view, I think the thing that makes this thing so immensely complicated that it defies solution is that we really can't talk about Afghanistan unless we also talk about Pakistan.
Pakistan, yes.
It's two pieces of a single problem, and the Afghan piece is the lesser piece. But nonetheless, let's just pretend, since I don't have
it's
a solution, since I don't have
a
solution
troops.
For Pakistan at all, let's pretend that Afghanistan exists in isolation. And there it seems to me that the beginnings of a strategy lie in recognizing that, at least best I can tell from my limited knowledge of Afghan history, the beginning of wisdom lies in acknowledging that effective governance over the territory of Afghanistan has never been wielded from Kabul. So the notion that we are going to create institutions in Kabul, which are going to govern that entire expanse of territory, means that we are going to do something that simply has never been done before. And it has been tried before, and other efforts have failed. So point number one would be, that is a very, very steep hill to climb. Point number two, though, would be, why not simply go with the way the Afghans do it? In other words, acknowledge that their political tradition, if you want to call it that, is one in which governance is decentralized, in which warlords or chieftains or whatever we want to call them, those are the people who wield effective authority over a particular expanse of ground, over a particular population. And quite frankly, as long from the strictly from the point of view of U.S. interests, and I acknowledge this sets aside, at least for the moment, moral concerns. Strictly from the point of view of U.S. interests, as long as the warlords are not entertaining and providing sanctuary to violent Islamic radicals, I don't know that we care much about the way they govern the regions over which they preside. And I believe that we can provide them with incentives that would help ensure that they would not provide sanctuary to Al-Qaeda or similar organizations. In other words, we can outsource the problem of ensuring that Afghanistan from here on out is not going to become what Afghanistan was in 2001. And I would at least like to see some consideration given to that approach. And I don't know that sending an additional 30 or 40,000 U.S. troops in the near term is necessary to make that approach work.
I think where I would ultimately come out is something of a hybrid, that approach should be taken wherever it's possible and where, frankly, the moral cost isn't too high. And there are some cases where actually there have already been deals done with warlords where the moral cost is extremely, extremely high, and the things that have been done and the folks that are walking around with impunity are just sort of horrifying to recount. And this is where, for me, I get to the end of my fondness for realism, because how do you judge the importance of a situation where the U.S. came in and said to the Afghan people, we will see that you don't have to go back to living under the warlords. And rightly or wrongly, that shouldn't have been done, should have been done. It was done. And now we're in a situation where if we say, oh, we've changed our minds and you're just stuck with these guys indefinitely, and yeah, that guy in Kabul, yeah, he's nice, but forget about him. The Constitution we helped you write, forget about that too. That, in addition to being a severe moral problem, and it's a severe moral problem whether you think we should have made the commitment in the first place or not, but it also becomes a practical problem, because if you can't trust the U.S. to do any variant of what we say we're going to do, how does that affect our sort of practical, realist, hard power going forward? And I think Afghanistan, while I completely agree with you that we can't pretend that we're going to govern, that anyone's going to govern Afghanistan from the center, that there needs to be a much more kind of robust effort to do exactly what you described and set up, help local regional authorities pursue both the things that are core U.S. national security interests and the things that are U.S. moral interests. But at a certain point, it is going to matter whether some of these things happen or not, if for no other reason than that we said they would, in my view.
Here's my view on the moral issue. If we're serious as a country on acquitting these moral obligations, and we do have moral obligations to the Iraqi people and to the Afghan people as a consequence of the policies that we've pursued over the past 7 years, then I think that we need to acquit the moral obligation in ways that, number one, actually redress the harm that we have done. And number two, that doesn't impose this effort to address our moral obligation on some small select group of American people, of Americans who are saying, you go make up for the sins of this country. And, of course, the small group of people that I'm referring to is the soldiers of the United States military.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I personally think that the argument that we owe a moral debt to the Afghan people, and so let's send some more soldiers there for their second or their third or their fourth combat tour is something that in which we as citizens therefore let ourselves off the hook. Nor am I sure that sending the additional soldiers there for their second or third or fourth combat tour actually directly addresses or redresses the harm that we've done. I mean, if as a consequence of if as a consequence of our involvement in Afghanistan, we've rendered 10,000 children orphans, well then let's bring the 10,000 children here to the United States. And let's give them the opportunity of living here, of making their lives here. Let's bring their, if they have any family members left, bring the family members here too. That would be a very palpable, specific, definite way of making up for the harm that we've done to person X, person Y, and person Z. In some senses, to me, if we simply say, oh my God, we've done all this moral harm, and therefore We're going to redouble the efforts that caused us to do the harm in the first place, I'm not sure that really fixes the moral problem.
No, I completely agree, and this seems like a good moment to go back and say again that this is an Afghanistan-Pakistan problem, not just an Afghanistan problem, and the way to both start fixing the strategy and to start redressing some of our, meeting some of our moral responsibility for having sort of helped the region down the path it's gone down would be, first of all, to fix our Pakistan strategy. Secondly, to change the way that we currently dump money into Pakistan's military establishment and then scratch our heads about how much of Pakistan's military establishment is out there supporting Islamist forces that are inimical to our interests, and reprogram those resources so that they're going to provide education, provide jobs, provide infrastructure, to create alternatives for folks who, you know, in Pakistan, as in some ways in Afghanistan, see no benefit whatsoever coming from the central government.
But is this not also where we just bump into these enormous, even if we intend as a people to redress our moral failings and our relations with these other countries, where the practicalities become so enormous? I mean, I don't think anybody at this stage of the game would look back at the history of U.S.-Pakistani relations and say that our policies were informed by any serious moral considerations, or I don't think we could say that our policies really were informed by any appreciation of the long-term consequences of what we were doing. With regard to Pakistan and many other countries, basically, we are simply responding to what seems to be urgent, immediate, near-term requirements. And where we are now with Pakistan reflects the consequences of that pattern of behavior, which extends over the period of decades. So we have helped, I wouldn't say that we're entirely responsible for, we have helped to create this system in Pakistan, this political system, in which civilian institutions have very little legitimacy, in which the military is deeply politicized, and also ineffective and inept, and has a set of priorities that are entirely at odds with our own priorities. And I'm just wondering how any effort on our part, however well-intentioned, could in any significant way undo all that we have done badly and foolishly over the course of 50 years. And that the moral course here, I mean, if you can't fix Pakistan, in some senses, the moral course is to try to take, for once, an enlightened view of what the interests of the United States require and the interests of the American people. And that doesn't have us plunging ever more deeply into Pakistan, at least in my view.
Well, I think this does two things. It brings up one really core difference that I think you and I do have, and it's about what the interests of the United States and its people are in an era marked by globalization, and whether globalization actually means anything as a secular trend outside of the U.S. and its consumerist economic and military policies or not. And I must say, if you just tuned into the dialogue at this point, you'd be entirely forgiven for assuming that the ideological assumptions on that one were the other way around, because you say at a point early on in the book that globalization is basically nothing but a U.S. marketing technique, and forgive me if I'm overstating your case a little bit, but knowing that you take a very classical view of what American interests are and how they can best be perceived, it's much more understandable that your instinct to retreat is so strong, whereas the view I take is that, yes, it would be much nicer if American national interests were served by retreating, and it would also be much nicer if morally we thought, well, at least we're not making things worse anymore by going home, but the kind of world in which our enemies can get cell phones and cards from around the world to plot against us and use the internet as their most effective recruiting and organizing tool and forward money, know-how, materiel all over the world, in which both all kinds of non-state actors can challenge state power in all kinds of different ways. I just don't agree with the extent to which you think that U.S. interests can actually best be protected by withdrawing from other societies. Now, where I do agree and where actually a vast amount of your critique I agree with, is that we have to change dramatically the way we interact with other societies. And I completely agree with you that getting in deeper with the Pakistani military isn't going to help. But just backing off entirely from Pakistani society is also not going to help. And just one really quick anecdote. I spent 3 days in December at a South Asia conference in Delhi where very high-level Pakistani, Indian, and Afghan people were brought together mostly to harangue the Americans about all that we had done wrong in the region, entirely deserved, I might add. But the three sort of contradictory demands that were made of us were, number one, get your troops out of the region. Number two, get rid of the warlords for us. And number three, fix Pakistan. And I was never able to figure out how anyone thought we could do all three of those things. Right. I was really hoping somebody would be able to tell me. But that it brings up another complication to both the moral and the realist argument, which is if the folks in the region are still expecting certain things of you, that has to be fed into your calculus as well.
Yeah, I actually think you said a whole lot there. I don't believe in disengagement. I certainly don't believe in isolationism. Matter of fact, I would argue emphatically that isolationism has never been a large aspect of U.S. foreign policy. That really, it's a tool that certain groups, I don't mean you at all, but certain groups use as a way to try to sort of discipline or narrow the parameters of debate about foreign policy. You simply label somebody an isolationist is kind of like labeling them an anti-Semite or a McCarthyite, you know, putting you beyond the bounds of decency. I do believe that, and this does go back to one of the core aspects of my book, I do believe there is an urgent need for us to get our own house in order. And that that sets priorities in a very important way. You know, fix America before you worry about fixing Pakistan. And to set that priorities has enormous consequences in terms of the distribution of resources. I mean, it just does. But I believe that. Secondly, I believe that if we could fix ourselves, if we could learn to live within our means, if we could live up to our professed values, if we could show that freedom was not simply conspicuous consumption and self-indulgence, but that freedom really was an idea to inform a collective life on this planet. In other words, if we could be once again the city upon a hill, that actually would do more towards bringing about positive change in places like Pakistan than any amount of sort of meddling in Pakistani society is likely to accomplish. Thirdly, I believe that our engagement with these other countries, and Pakistan would be an example, should de-emphasize hard power considerations, should emphasize soft power, should involve educational exchange, cultural exchange, academic exchange and interaction, but, and I would underscore but here about three times, with never expectations that the effect we would have would be other than on the margins. Useful, but always on the margins. You know, to the people who say, get rid of the warlords, or solve some other problems. I think what we need to say is that, folks, the United States of America is not going to solve your problems. We can't. If your problems have solutions, then you're going to have to devise the solutions and you're going to have to implement the solutions because what the expectations that others have of us, and I'm with you, I have conversations with people from abroad who somehow think that the President of the United States can snap his fingers and, you know, fix the problems of of Zimbabwe, or you know, you fill in the blanks. That is simply not a useful way of thinking about what role we can play or ought to play in the world. So we need to help people lower their expectations of what the United States can actually contribute.
So I guess my one quibble with, or it's a pretty big quibble with that, really. But no, because I agree with you that it's completely wrong-headed of us to think we can fix society X or Y or Z, and that's been the source that's the fundamental source of many of the problems that this administration has had in spades. But it's a neurosis shared across the political spectrum in the United States. But it's also true that we can often not do more than be at the margins, but we can sometimes be at the margin in a key tipping point kind of way. And I think of eliminating polio. I think of eliminating smallpox. I think of the work that's been done on AIDS, which, while on the one hand has been gruesomely slow, on the other hand, it's because of a certain group of campaigners in the U.S. and then the U.S. government that as much money and attention has been focused on it as have been.
It's good.
So I'm a great proponent of the modest agenda, mm-hmm. and of the sort of the difficult balance. And this is, I think, a concept I want to close with, because it was one of the most profound things in your book, of finding a place where you're not trying to re-engineer other people's societies for them, but you are trying to see what positive trends are emerging within a society and support those, and where there's a crying out hunger for, mm-hmm. say, mm-hmm. elementary schools in mm-hmm. rural Pakistan, just to pick one example. But you quote Niebuhr. You quote Niebuhr saying that societies aren't individuals and governments should act in their own self-interest, and there's no other way for governments to act, and it's unrealistic to expect governments to be selfless. But then you also quote him talking about how a society, a government, needs to find a balance between its self-interest imperatives and its moral imperatives, and that seems to me where we've gotten as a society, sort of where our dialogue gets so out of whack that we can't have the discussion without it being pulled off in this direction of, oh, we have these enormous moral imperatives which just happen to match enormous strategic imperatives, and that there's a real need for the sort of small C conservatives and the small L liberals to contribute more to saying, look, there is both a moral and a self-interest piece of this balance.
I think, so we can end up here shaking hands. I think you're exactly right. Let's take the example of the AIDS program, which is mostly, and I'm not an expert on this, but vastly expanded under the Bush administration. One of his few great foreign policy successes, I would say.
Yep.
And you know, whether that came about as a result of outside pressure or because the president simply believed it was an important and good thing to do, I don't know. I'm not sure it really matters all that much. But that to me is an example of what I mean by programs that have a marginal difference. Now, it's not marginal to the probably several million people who are benefiting from that program. I mean marginal in a strategic sense that effort alone is not going to have a transformative effect on sub-Saharan Africa. But it can make a contribution. It is the kind of thing that we should be doing. And even if only marginally, I think that the strategic justification for programs like that is very easy to make. So yeah, we should be doing less of that, not more. More of that, not less. Sorry.
Well, on that note, I have to go run a staff meeting where I pledged to sign the staff your book as a challenge. So
great.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and have a good new year.
I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.